This is a Rabble Podcast Network show. New voices in your head. It's Radio Free Radio.
You're listening to Red Eye on Vancouver Cooperative Radio, CFRO 100.5 FM.
The 36th annual Vancouver Gay Pride Parade is less than a month away. It's one of the city's premier events of the summer, and it regularly attracts hundreds of thousands of spectators. And it shows off Vancouver as one of the most gay-friendly cities in the world. Canada was one of the first nations to allow same-sex marriage, and now 16 countries allow it. Even American sitcoms feature gay characters, something that would have been unthinkable a couple of decades ago. And that's all within the first decade and a half of this century. Seems like the fight for gay acceptance is all but over, right? To talk about this issue is Susanna Denuta-Walter. She's currently Director of Women's, Gender, and Sexuality Studies at Northeastern University in Boston, where she's also Professor of Sociology. Professor Walter's new book is The Tolerance Trap: How God, Genes, and Good Intentions Are Sabotaging Gay Equality. And she joins me on the phone from Boston, Massachusetts. Hello, Susanna.
Hello, great to be here.
Yeah, great to talk to you. On the surface of it, the idea of tolerance seems like an admirable goal. So why do you call tolerance a trap?
Well, of course, tolerance is better than its inverse. I mean, I'll take tolerance over vicious gay bashing any day. So, you know, we've got to say that. But when you think about the word itself, it really implies kind of holding your nose at something that you don't really like. So we talk about we tolerate a boring meeting, or we tolerate a rainy day, or we tolerate, a nasty infection that we have. We don't really talk about tolerating things that we enjoy or that give us pleasure. We don't talk about tolerating a beautiful day, or tolerating wonderful sex, or tolerating a brilliantly written novel. So tolerance almost always, I think, implies something we kind of begrudgingly accept, but that we would rather do without. And it seems to me a very low bar to set for a social movement. So to say what we want is tolerance, I think is a real mistake. I mean, for many of us, you know, I think for all of us, we say, but we didn't come out of the closet in order to be tolerated. We came out of the closet and we live our lives in order to be full citizens, to be embraced, to be celebrated for our difference, not to be tolerated in spite of it. So I think it's not just a low bar, but it also presents a trap in some ways, because I think tolerance doesn't push back on heterosexual dominance. It lets it stand in place. Tolerance says, okay, you don't have to like us. You can think we're gross and disgusting still, but you have to hold your nose and tolerate us. And that's no way to build a really robust civil society that embraces difference and really pushes back against bigotry and anti-gay animus. And so I think tolerance is a very narrow framework with which to imagine a more gay-positive future.
How has the term gay pride changed over the last few decades?
Well, it's interesting you ask that, because, you know, this book came out in Gay Pride Month in June, and I was doing a lot of touring around with it and talking about that. And I've always had some hesitancy about the term pride. It always seems such a strange sort of concept of thinking about identity. But I'll tell you, now in this day and age when all we're talking about are these tepid notions of acceptance and tolerance and we're just the same as you, I actually am much more feeling much more friendly to the notion of pride. Because when you think about it, pride really isn't about you. It's not about the mainstream saying, I tolerate you or I accept you. Pride is something you have and you insist upon. So actually, I would love if the gay movement really embraced that older conception of pride. We're here, we're queer, get used to it. That notion, rather than a notion of we're here, we're kind of gayish, I hope you just tolerate us. And I think that's sort of where we are now. And the other currents that have been a part of the history of, very much a part of the history of the gay rights movement all around the world, I think need to be reinvigorated and reimagined, as we enter this kind of tolerance era.
How did same-sex marriage become such a dominant issue within gay rights? Now that, I mean, you see that everywhere, as if that somehow equates with equality.
Yeah, of course, that drives me crazy, the fact that it equates with equality. I mean, I think that's the biggest problem with what's happened with gay marriage stuff is that, look, of course it's a civil right that one needs to have. It's a basic, fundamental social institution, for better or for worse. It is a social institution, and you know, excluding a group of people from it is patently discriminatory. So that has to be said, and I applaud the work that activists have made on this. But you're absolutely right. The idea that this has become the not only the sort of centerpiece of gay rights, but become equated and conflated with gay rights. So if you go on the internet and search for gay rights, let me tell you something. 9 times out of 10, you're going to get articles and newspapers and pundits on gay marriage, as if gay marriage is the sign of the full achievement of gay rights, which, of course, is illusory. I mean, I think that the movement, you know, there's a lot of reasons, a lot of complicated reasons why marriage became the centerpiece. I think one reason just has to do with legal cases and the victories and how they, you know, when they started rolling in, I think part of it became very difficult to imagine something else, you know, because they were so, you know, really surprisingly successful in this movement. But I also think it's a real easy one. It says to straight people, you know, here, we just want a piece of what you have. We're no different than you. All we want is just to, you know, get married, raise our kids in our suburban households, and go to PTA meetings, and we're just like you. So there's a way in which it's a very safe way for liberal straight allies to support gay rights without having to think about sexual difference, without having to think about sex, without having to think about liberation and freedom in the ways that we used to imagine it.
Now, in your book, you call same-sex marriage the perfect Trojan horse for the tolerance trap. But explain that mechanism to me.
Yeah, I mean, I do think part of what's happened here is that marriage, because marriage comes to be seen as the sign of gay victory, of, you know, well, we've got all these marriage rights happening now, therefore the battle's over. You know, we have achieved a post-gay world in some way. And that's what I mean by Trojan horse, is that it slips in this fantasy of inclusion and full integration and full victory. And in fact, you know, what it is only one single victory. And so the idea that you know, marriage comes to stand for all things gay victorious is, in fact, I think, undermining the potential for really thinking more broadly and deeply about gay inclusion and a more gay-friendly and supportive and embracing world. And so I think, you know, I think the focus on the marriage movement and the way in which it's come to be the centerpiece of gay rights is a real problem. It's a real problem for the movement. Now, I'm not the only one who's been saying this. Of course, lots of, you know, more radical queer activists and feminists, of course, have been talking and writing about this for years. But I'll tell you, if you looked at the mainstream media, you would think that all gays want to be married and that all gays think that marriage is the central issue and that all straight people, the way they support gay rights is by supporting gay marriage. And so all the other panoply of issues, from, you know, the disproportionate numbers of queer youth that are in the homeless population to disparities in economic, you know, abilities of different kinds of queer populations to racial disparities and discrimination, all of that gets pushed to the side in the rush to the altar.
What would from the side of gay activists or gay people who are agitating for change or looking for a wider agenda, what would a more progressive family agenda look like?
Well, it's an interesting question. I speak to you as a mother here. I have a 20-year-old daughter, and you know what you mostly see in terms of family stuff, and this has happened around the marriage rights movement as well, is the argument that our families are no different. You should let us, you know, let us have our rights because our, you know, raising kids of gay parents, for example, there's all these things that come out. Kids of gay parents do no worse, that do not suffer, and do no worse than kids of straight parents. Now, you know, I think there's a whole other argument to be made, which is let's in fact look at the kinds of different ways gay people form families. I mean, a family has been structured around an opposition between a male and female person, and therefore about gender norms and gender stereotypes. How is family different when gender opposition is taken out of the picture? You know, do kids of gay parents have broader, more expansive thinking about sexuality and gender and sexual freedom and liberation? One would hope so. So I think there's a whole other argument to be made about queer families, which is to say, no, of course we're not like you. Difference matters. And in fact, straight people, you can learn a lot about how to rethink kinship and rethink family by looking at how gay people form families and form broader kinship networks, you know, not just through biological families, but through what we call families of choice, the ways in which, you know, there's a wider sense of an understanding of kinship. But that can't be made. That argument can't be made if all you're banking on is tolerance, sameness, and acceptance.
I wanted to explore another issue that you address in your book. You've got a section about genes and sexuality. What's behind this search for a gay gene, or sometimes an assertion that there is a gay gene, or that it's that your sexual orientation is a biological imperative?
Yeah, that in fact is drives me more crazy than anything, I think, even than marriage. You know, the idea of being born that way, of there being some immutability or hardwired nature of sexual identity, it has now become, at least in the United States, the new normal. I mean, that is the way. If you support gay rights, you're supposed to believe that gays are born that way. End of story. It is the party line for liberal allies of gay rights, and by the way, for much of the gay movement. And there's a number of problems with that. Number one, of course, the science is very thin there. They're small studies with small sample sizes. Most of them have not been replicated. Most of them are based on already problematic gender-based science, which assumes fundamental brain differences between men and women. So there's all kinds of scientific problems with that. But for me, the problem is actually a different one, even if the science were good, which is that the question of how you got there is irrelevant to the question of civil rights. In other words, it should have no place. The question of origin should have no place in discussions of civil rights. I should get my rights because I am a human being. How I got there, whether I think I'm born this, whether I think it's a choice, whether I've changed over the life course, my sexuality in a variety of ways, is irrelevant to the question of a human rights discourse and a civil rights discourse. And I guess what I find so troubling is the way in which born this way, from Lady Gaga to court cases all around the country, the way born this way has become the only way to think about not only identity, but how to access civil rights. And I find that terrifying because, you know, of course, biologically determinist ideas have a terrible history all over the world. The history of anti-Semitism and the Holocaust, the history of racism and slavery, the history of misogyny and anti-woman activities have all been based on notions of absolute biological differences. And so the idea that the gay rights movement is banking on biologically determinist arguments to make a case for rights is, to say the least, ironic, and to say the most dangerous and short-sighted. And, you know, I've spent a lot of time around this book sort of pushing back against that idea. I find it very, very troubling. It also, of course, does such a disservice to the complexity of human sexuality and desire to say it's this singular thing. Of course, most of us experience sexuality in much more complicated ways than that. People change their desires and identities over a life course. Some people, of course, feel equally attracted to both genders. You know, it is just a very narrow and simplistic way of understanding the messy complexity of human sexuality.
So it's not just like an on-off choice, like you have the gene, which is the gay gene or the straight gene, and I don't know, maybe some kind of mashup for people who are bisexual.
Well, of course, you know, I mean, what should tell you a lot about this science is that no one's looking for the straight gene. I mean, when they talk about the science of human sexuality and of sexual orientation, when they talk about that, they're talking about gay sexual orientation. And in fact, one of the things that's really troubling, what underlies all of this, is an assumption that no one would choose to be gay. So part of the proof of a biological origin of sexual orientation is the idea that this is such a horrible thing that no one would choose it. which is a terrible way to think about queer sexuality. I mean, the idea that we would reject that choice, that the notion that one could choose to be gay, that this is a great choice, this is a wonderful choice, is anathema in our culture. You know, you're a good gay if you believe you're born that way, because God knows no one would choose to be gay because gayness is so horrible. So there's a way in which the born this way ideology keeps bigotry in hand. It keeps it right there. It starts with an assumption that you would not, no one would want to be have this, that this is foisted upon you through your genes or through some endocrine system malfunction. And of course, always with the idea of looking for origins or causation is the idea of cure, right? If this is a problem, maybe we can fix it. So it's presuming there's a problem to be known and therefore a problem that can be fixed. And my argument is there's no problem here. There's not a problem. There's not a mystery to be solved here.
I find myself listening to you and actually hearing many kind of conversations I've had with myself around around genes and around gay marriage and the kind of sort of traditional and constraining aspects of that. And I wonder if you see your book then as a way to kind of wedge open the discussion on that, because I think there's probably a lot of gay people who have kind of like gone along with the, okay, gay marriage, whatever, and sort of sit silent because you're trying to get some rights and you're trying to see some progressiveness. But at the same time, you see these incredibly constraining arguments that you don't agree with.
Well, I couldn't have said it better myself. Exactly. I mean, I do very much see this book as attempting to open up space for a broader national conversation about sexual freedom, sexual rights, and gender freedom. Then I do think that the leaders of the gay movement, our national spokespeople and our national discourse the reins need to be loosened up a little so that we can have a broader discussion and a deeper discussion that goes beyond, you know, the simplicity of immutability, of acceptance, of tolerance, and really has a more utopian sort of vision of a world of more gender freedom and sexual freedom. And I do think, of course, there's a great history of that in the gay rights movement, a wonderful history of that. But I think as you say, I mean, one of the things that happens with gaining some victories and becoming more mainstreamed and normalized is that often much of the radicalism gets pushed to the side. And I think we've gotten on this marriage bandwagon, we've gotten on this born this way bandwagon, and we need to get off it, and we need to rejoin with some of our persistently more radical and progressive voices in the movement, and particularly rejoin with the feminist movement and with questions of gender equity and freedom, because gender equity and sexual freedom are intimately linked. You cannot separate them, and you shouldn't. And, you know, I think that's why so many feminists have been so critical of what's happened with the gay movement particularly in terms of marriage. I mean, here is an institution that many of us as feminists have spent our lifetimes critiquing, and the idea that would become the brass ring of gay equality, getting married, is pretty sad.
You know, it's been a great conversation this morning, and as a result, I vow to actually take a stand on some of these issues that I think I've let myself be a bit quiet on.
Well, good. Then I've done my job.
You've done your job with me. It's been a great pleasure talking with you this morning.
Wonderful talking with you. Thanks so much.
Bye now.
Bye-bye.
I've been speaking with Susanna Denuta Walters. She's a professor of sociology at Northeastern University in Boston, Massachusetts. Her new book is called The Tolerance Trap: How God, Genes, and Good Intentions Are Sabotaging Gay Equality, and is published by New York University Press.